Talking with you.
The student's point of view.
We are here to talk.
We are here to ask.
We are here to learn.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Talking With You, the podcast where the student's point of view matters. This show wants to provide the students with an open and safe space to discuss the topics they would deal with as students, but also in a broader sense, the ones that concern us the most as young, passionate individuals. My name is Daniele.
And my name is Arianna, and we will be hosting today's episode. In this episode, we will revisit a topic that we all wanted to forget, the COVID-19 pandemic. A once-in-a-century pandemic, fingers crossed, that had the world in its grip and radically limited the way we European lives for 3 years. Now that this chapter is over, after the World Health Organization lifted the pandemic alert, as well as all restrictions were abolished by national governments, you probably wonder why we're gonna go back there. Well, because the consequences of the pandemic are still visible today, particularly for us students when it comes to missed chances of meeting friends, traveling, pursuing hobbies and sports, learning backlogs or mental health, but just as well when thinking about access to the quality of higher education, inequalities to put it short. And this exists on a personal level, a sociological level, but even also when looking at the big EU arena.
Precisely, and this will be the defining topic of today's episode, looking at inequalities during the COVID-19 pandemic and how the EU responded. And to start with, we're excited to have fresh and possibly also surprising data from a recent study conducted by our very own Institute of European Studies. But before we get there, as always, let me first introduce our two guests of today. Catherine Jeffrey, member of Eisen Europe and European Studies Master Student.
Hello.
And Hélène Bollat, member of SAIES and also European Studies Master Student at the IEE.
Hello.
Hello again to the both of you, and thank you for coming today.
Welcome on the show. As mentioned before, when talking about inequalities during the COVID-19, we can both look at the personal level, but as well as the overall picture. We'd like to start off by hearing from your personal experience before diving back into the EU politics world. So let's zoom in and what the study discovered. According to the study, based on 61 students from more than 11 countries, surprisingly and on a positive note, 58% of students credit their universities for providing effective online support, and more than 81% of students had wholly limited to no impact on their housing situation. On the other side, more than 83% experienced limitation in terms of networking, academic connection, and social opportunities. And lastly, 41% stated the pandemic reduced opportunities and increased competition, leaving more than half of the respondents with a feeling of uncertainty for their own future. With all that in mind, how do you assess the results of this study in the light of equal chances for all students, and how much do they match with your own experience at university during COVID and your attitude toward the future outlook?
So pandemic has been challenging for everybody, but compared to other social groups, young people have been disproportionately impacted upon by the pandemic, and this will bring some scars on youth in general. Particular challenge was faced by students who had moved away from their parents' home to go to university, and the pandemic had forced them to make difficult choices between returning home to their families or staying in their town or city where their university was. And staying in their university town meant a risk also of precarious living situation, as the limited opportunity also for students' job made paying rent and charges much more difficult, of course. But then at the same time, returning home was felt by some to be detrimental to learning, as also the pandemic prevented the possibility of using other services such as libraries and etc. So, but also international students perceived a strong sense of displacement in the end. They had to choose between remaining far away from home without strong networks or returning to the home countries at the detriment of their education. My own experience reflects a bit this upheaval. I had to cut short my Erasmus exchange in Germany just as the pandemic hit. But while disappointing, I know I am privileged in this sense compared to others. I've seen friends of mine struggle, lost internships and delayed graduations, and some also had to move back with their parents after finally gaining independence.
And what about you, Aline?
So in my case, when COVID started and with the lockdown, I started my first year of uni in a new country. So it wasn't here in Belgium, but I was living here with my parents because my university was still close to my home. And it was horrible because I had any connection with the other students. So socially, it was very bad. And still after those 3 years, I can say that I have any close friends from my bachelor university. Mm. I thought that it was just me because I had any contacts with other students, but actually I wasn't alone. I know that my university had place or support to talk about that, which was nice. Like the university was very professional and the experiences was very nice. All my courses were online. The exams were also online. There was like some pros and cons. If I compare with the experiences of my friends here in Belgium. In Belgium, it was horrible because all the course, it was just podcasts or online courses, but the exam were like in the campus. So there was like this difficulty of being at home, but doing exam being at the university, which it wasn't my case. But yeah, it was socially and mentally very bad.
And in what country is the university where you did your first part of your studies?
It was in the Netherlands. So also in that point of view, I was like between two countries with different rules about the COVID. Yeah. So sometimes the Netherlands were like, okay, we start the lockdown, which wasn't the case in Belgium. Yeah, it wasn't difficult to follow the rules of both countries.
And do you think the pandemic changed the future outlook after the university experience?
Well, yeah, I think that everything's a bit more uncertain for sure, in the sense that, say, when you are in your 20s, it's precisely the time when you want to be much more independent and so on. So, well, all of a sudden you need to go back to your parents' house and renounce to these forms of independence. Then also you are going to question a bit all your future steps that are going to come.
Yeah, I agree, like there is still a change of the future outlook, but also regarding the opportunities, I would say that it depends. Sometimes it changed. Maybe you have less opportunities or maybe more opportunities. At the end, I don't know if it was maybe helpful for some students, but some students started to change their studies or they decided to not study anymore.
Thank you, girls, for bringing out the situation for international students and students who live away from home in general. Also, from the professional point of view and from the relationship, friendships and the human relation in general during this difficult time.
And now to try and draw a line with the political side of this of the podcast, the pandemic and the countermeasures taken by states not only created inequalities when looking at the access and quality of higher education for students, but also in the general population overall. And also in this context, we have a big variety in how citizens were able to cope with the consequences. While families and households with higher incomes were of course less affected by the imposed restrictions and consequences, vulnerable and low-income families and households were particularly hit, and those that found themselves on the verge of poverty often fell into it. Then, particularly when looking into socioeconomic impact on vulnerable families, for example, in the drop of quality in education for children, without the means to pay for private tutoring lessons, as opposed to high-income households that could counterbalance the reduced supply in the education sector. Low-income workers also without the possibility to work remotely, who either had to keep going to work and put themselves and their families at risk, or could not work for years and even lost their job due to the economic fallout. So we see a big difference in how people were able to cope with the pandemic. The EU, for instance, tried at least to offset the socioeconomic impacts by launching programs such as the SURE program in 2020, a program that was intended to give member states loans to handle the extra costs of keeping people unemployed and instead fund short-time work schemes to help people stay in their jobs. Still, there have been some doubts and criticisms about whether the European institutions did enough in response to the pandemic to reduce pre-existing inequalities for vulnerable citizens, which were often also reinforced by the pandemic itself. What's your view on this aspect? Has the EU done enough? Should it and could it have done more? Helene, would you like to start?
Yeah, for sure. I would say no, I don't think so. It's also, I think, complicated for the EU to implement something at the time because you still have the power of the member states to also put the rules and apply some, I don't know, some, you know, regarding the job, the unemployment. So I would say no.
So no in the sense that it could not have done more?
They could done more in the side that they can help more the member states, like helping the member states to provide some plan to help those vulnerable citizens. I think the EU couldn't do something on their own. It's like not has climate change say to, okay, you need to reduce, I don't know, carbon to 20 in which percent. It's like telling them if you are doing this in that way, maybe it will be helpful for you to help those vulnerable citizens.
I see. Thank you. And Catherine, what's your view on this?
Yeah, well, determining whether the EU did enough to address inequalities is a bit tricky. The EU often found itself reacting rather than proactively acting and planning ahead, very often navigating compromises in emergency situations. The economic recession coming from the pandemic had very asymmetrical effects, with southern European countries being particularly strongly affected, with the communication and technology sector that has benefited from the COVID crisis, while tourism, travel and services have strongly suffered. And the total employment has almost covered, but the young and those with low-level qualifications have suffered from employment losses. So against this backdrop, the EU was confronted with two main challenges in the end. That firstly, there was a growing pressure to establish fast and effective crisis responses and mechanisms at the EU level. And secondly, there were greater demands also for the budget to be allocated towards new areas where it could have a greater impact. So the response, yes, was fast, with SURE, the program SURE, that was introduced within a few weeks after the announcement of the first lockdown, if I remember well. And the program's SURE's success highlights also the necessity for such instruments not only during the pandemic, but also for future crises that may impact employment. So yeah, and then let's keep in mind that the greatest innovation for the EU during the pandemic was yet a lot of money coming from the Next Generation EU that was also a protracted response to the euro crisis, but also the suspension of fiscal discipline rules that have surely undermined social spending up until then. So yeah, the pandemic has undeniably triggered great EU action. The question now is, what comes next?
Yes, definitely. There's also a question of what the EU can do, like in terms of what the treaties allow it to do. Because, for example, in terms of reducing inequalities, the social policy isn't particularly strong at the European level. It still remains very much a national competence. So it is true that also institutionally, there's only so much that the EU can do. And the response has been swift in certain cases. In other cases, it's a bit more bumpy, more of a bumpy ride, but thank you for bringing the attention on this particular aspect too.
And in an even broad context, when we look at the different precondition of the member states' economies and financial abilities, social security and health system, we see other big pre-existing inequalities reinforced by the COVID-19 pandemic. That's why the EU member states, together with the EU institution, agree in 2020 on a recovery plan for Europe, accounting for 1.8 trillion euros together with its centerpiece, Next Generation EU, a 800 billion euro investment program in health, green investments and digital technology. As only a handful of member states could have tackled the socioeconomic consequences by themselves, this plan allowed the EU for the first time to borrow common debt for all member states, trying to eliminate the inequality when it came to money borrowing capacities between high-income and low-income member states. Looking back, was the recovery plan for Europe a success, and what is needed to reduce the economy and social inequalities between the different member states in the long term?
So looking back to the recovery plan for Europe, it was a significant step toward addressing economic and social inequality. So yeah, the EU investments, had to say, the 1.8 trillion euro to help the member states recover and prioritize spending on healthcare and etc., promote a long-term growth and resilience. However, reducing economic and social inequalities require more than just providing financial support. A comprehensive approach is needed that tackles the roots, causes and fosters inclusive growth growth. This means that implementing structural reforms, investing in education and skills development, and ensuring that everyone has equal access to opportunities. So to reduce inequalities between different member states in the long term, sustain a commitment and collaboration from all stakeholders, including the government, businesses, civil society, and citizens is necessary. By working together, we can build a better Europe that is more resilient, prosperous, and inclusive for future generations.
And for you, Catherine?
Yeah, I agree with Helene. I think it's still too early to judge if the EU's recovery plan has succeeded or not, because it depends a lot on how member states use this money in the end, no? So let's say that the EU has to manage a recovery that is both sustainable and equitable. And the EU's landmark recovery instrument to address various divergences among the EU countries and between the core and the periphery, as you said, the Next Generation EU, and therefore the resilience plans, have a big challenge on green and digital transitions. And these orientation and conditionalities towards green and digital spending are certainly welcome, but do not really focus on preventing scarring risks in labor markets, for instance. So national fiscal support programs and social policies targeted at those most affected remain still necessary to prevent scarring, and it's imperative for the member states to prioritize also certain spending objectives that have significant long-term social impacts, such as healthcare, for example, within the broader framework of the recovery plan. For instance, if I can just make an example, Italy is the top beneficiary of the EU recovery fund, but it's facing serious challenges in its health system. Recently, a group of scientists has published an open letter calling for more investment to save Italy's national health service, which has been deteriorating for years. And Italy spends much less on healthcare compared to other European countries. Health spending in Italy is about 6% of the GDP, whereas in France and Germany, it was above 10% already in 2022. So this has led to increasing territorial and social inequalities, with increasing difficulty in access to diagnosis and treatment within the country. Many people, when they could, turned to private healthcare, and those who cannot often go into debt to do so. So we have to keep in mind that also the unstoppable technological evolution, with the consequent increase in costs, and never forget the aging population of Europe, and also the changing disease scenarios, pose new challenges to our national health system. And a functioning health service does not only protect health in the end, but also the social cohesion of the country as a whole.
And so in the long term, what do you think would be an advisable path to make sure that fighting inequalities at the European level is sustainable? Would it be, I don't know, more funding or a different way to distribute this funding, or common debt, or even treaty revision? The competencies of the European institutions being increased, what would you think could ensure a longer sustainability of the fight against inequalities at a European level?
Well, for more funding, yeah, in the end, as I said, it depends a lot on how member states would actually spend that amount of money. So it's not only a question of the size, let's say, of the EU budget spent on social issues, the more the better, anyway. But also, I believe that in the end, the EU is this strange animal that moves really very slowly and only through crisis, which is also its limit. So yeah, probably COVID and the pandemic has opened, let's say, a window of opportunity also for the EU to gain much more competencies, for example, on health issues, health policies. I mean, let's see.
Thank you so much to both of you for sharing your experience, your idea and suggestion. And let's hope to see some positive change at the European level for our future.
But before the end, we would like to express a very special thank you to our two guests, Helene and Catherine, for joining us today to discuss this topic that hits very close to home, in the sense that it was very close to our personal experience as a student who have lived through the pandemics. And also, like, it is really relevant for the kind of future that we can expect to have in front of us. And thank you also to the Institute of European Studies for providing the study that was the basis for this episode. And last but not least, thanks to all of you for listening to one more episode of Talking With You, the Student's Point of View. Until next time.
This podcast was sponsored by the Institut d'Études Européennes of the Université Libre de Bruxelles, which we thank for the opportunity of this space.